Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. I'm Bob Dumo, your host for the Buzz on Technical Rescue. Today's show is coming live from Firehouse World in San Diego, California. Our podcast today is going to take a look at some case histories and background on high angle rescue and cliff rescues on the California coast. I'm pleased to be joined today by John Bates, Sherman Peters, and Kyle O'Neill, are all from the California State Fire Marshal's Office as instructors. John is a Federal Fire Department member in San Diego, where he's a captain, and also an instructor with Firetown Training Specialists. Sherman's a captain with the National City Fire Department in California, also an instructor with Rescue Systems 1 and Low Angle Rope Rescue for the Fire Marshal's Office, and Kyle is a firefighter with the San Diego Fire Department, currently assigned to Rescue 4. Gentlemen, thanks for joining me today.
Glad to be here.
Okay, what we're going to look at is a couple activities. What we start out with is maybe each of your individual departments, how you address an incident such as a rope rescue, high angle type of incident for your department. John, how's it work in the federal firefighting?
Well, as you know, as a federal fire department, we're responsible for all your federal assets and naval districts here in San Diego. Currently, we run two ladder companies, and both ladder companies are set up to handle most things at the low angle rope rescue type operational needs, limited high angle. We have a strong automatic aid agreement with San Diego City, where we use Rescue 4, which Kyle's a member of. Most of our folks are trained at the academy level basic rescue type techniques, but both members on both of our ladder companies are trained in Rescue Systems 1 and low angle rope rescue.
Excellent. And Kyle, from the San Diego Fire Department's perspectives, what would be a typical response for you for folks?
Well, we work hand in hand with all the other outer agencies, responding to cliff rescues, also anything on the inland side. We are working on Rescue 4. We technically will head out to most incidents that involve rope rescue or any kind of technical expertise.
With that, do you have certain companies within the department that are assigned to this, or do multiple companies carry the equipment and have the training to address these types of rescues?
We have one heavy rescue, which will basically go out on any of those, like I said, any of those responses. The district which the incident's taking place in, those units will still respond, but they'll have Rescue 4 responding in addition to their response, and several other companies, mainly for manpower, to be able to actually use the equipment with our guidance. And also we would have our copter show up to give us a good aerial view, kind of our bird's eye view of the incident. We also will have, if it's a cliff rescue, we'll have the lifeguards there to help with any kind of water hazard. Sometimes it, for example, it just might be that we need to lower the person into the water off the cliff, and they'll get a boat down there ready for us to help facilitate that.
So because of the terrain you're dealing with, this really brings in all components of your department working together for the successful outcome, if not multiple departments, depending on the size of it. Sherman, in National City, what type of rope rescue do you people deal with?
We have everybody on the department is trained to the Rescue Systems 1 level at a minimum, and there are some that are trained at a little bit higher level than that. Most fire departments in Southern California have technical rescue training to some degree, whether or not they have cliff responses as part of their districts. We have high-rise rescues, and we have below-ground rescues, and the techniques and the methods are more or less the same. So, and because there's automatic aid agreements throughout Southern California with all the different agencies, like Kyle and John had alluded to, we have a potential to assist other agencies or other agencies assist us with technical rescue operations. So we have, our engine companies have ropes and a minimum cache of technical rope rescue equipment, and then our truck company has a full complement of rope rescue equipment to use. And we rely on other agencies for manpower, but we're trained to the level of being able to accomplish anything that might come along.
So it's very similar to what we would do on the East Coast, where we have the equipment, but we still see the reality that to get the manpower you need for events of this caliber, that we do need to rely upon one another. And as we talk further on, I'm sure training together is equally as important, and
That's
we'll touch
correct.
On that a little bit later. From the federal fire department's perspective, John, equipment-wise, do you carry similar equipment to what the municipal departments would carry?
Yes, absolutely. One of the nice things about, I think, the system that we have in California, and I'm sure Sherm will touch on that as far as rescue systems, one, it's given us the ability to see a real common ground as far as techniques and equipment goes for us. I carry the exact same stuff Sherman's carrying on his ladders, similar equipment that Kyle's carrying on Rescue 4, even though rescue trucks do carry things that are specialized for specific incidences. You know, I'm on a ladder company, so we carry, two rope bags and the equipment that supports that type of operation.
Excellent. And it sounds very similar to what our department does on the East Coast as well, where our rescue brings the additional resources that sometimes just don't fit on our other equipment, and the fiscal responsibility of some of the tools are so seldom used, you don't need one on every truck in the department. But by having a specialized vehicle, be it a heavy rescue or a special operations type of response vehicle, we're also giving our community the best service possible at the fairest dollar value.
Oh, I absolutely agree, especially with today's situation with the economy, and departments are fighting for budgets. You know, they got to compete with a lot of other folks. So we're seeing ourselves being asked to do a lot more with less. So interagency capabilities between communities and common ground on equipment is a key to success.
Excellent. One of the things I was told about when I first got out here this week was a job that took place back in fall of 2009 at the Cabrillo National Monument. A couple of you here were actually actively engaged in that incident. Why don't we start out, the more case history component of today's talk. Let's relate it back to that call. Kyle, you were one of the first in members on that call, correct?
That's correct.
When you got there, just kind of give us a little quick overview of what you guys had facing you when you arrived.
Well, basically, we were kind of put into the response a little bit towards the end of the response, actually after the first arriving engine companies were on scene, figured out that they needed to turn this into a rescue response due to the rope rescue type scenario. The Cabrillo National Monument, just to give you like an idea of what it would look like, it's the point of San Diego. It's out there by the bluffs, and there's a lot of cliffs, and there's an area there where a lot of tourists go. And two elderly gentlemen around 11 a.m. were driving in, and one of them, when they went to park on the cliff's edge, accidentally hit the accelerator instead of the brake and launched their truck down over the side of the cliff and to about 450 feet down over the side. And as we arrived, we started to develop a plan of getting down to the victims, assessing the scene, and figuring out what is needed as far as that goes. Through the response, there was three engines, two trucks, two battalion chiefs, Rescue 4, and Copter 1 to assist in giving us an idea of how far down this is.
When you reached the victims, were they still in their vehicle? Did you have extrication issues, or were they ejected or able to get out on their own?
Neither of the victims were ejected. The one victim was still trapped when we got on scene. There were a couple other individual firefighters that went down on a rope line and were able to extricate that one victim, which the copter then was able to take to the hospital. They brought him up on the winch and took them in. We still had a victim down below who was ours, so we had to set up rope systems to extricate that guy out.
So at that point, we can definitely see the magnitude growing. When we talk to people about rope rescue incidents, they get very single focused on just the ropes and what we're doing. Now here you're dealing with a situation where you have an MVA over the hill. You're looking at extrication, be it complicated or what we would consider in the fire service is a very basic or straightforward event, still highly complicated because it's over a cliff. It's not along the roadway, not on the middle of an expressway or in someone's neighborhood. So as we look at this, we see how this thing grew and all the different resources in the community are going to be taxed or at least put to labor. John, the Federal Fire Department was called in as well to assist on this?
Yes, actually our station 110 is actually up on Point Loma, not very far from where the event taken. It's very common for our engine company to respond to medical aids, folks that get stuck down in the area of tide pools. They're an engine company, as a lot of communities have. They're pretty limited on what they have on their vehicle. Once the first arriving company officer realizes, this isn't just over the edge, this is approximately 400 feet over the edge, he called for immediate resources. And like Kyle said, we ended up with numerous engines and from two different jurisdictions. And again, probably one of the things that impressed me the most or I saw happen very well was the amount of communications that took place, the size up, the communication between rigs. I know for myself, I was responding in a ladder company from quite a distance away, and Kyle's coming from downtown on Rescue 4. Because of the time travel that it took us to get there, we were able to get a good size up from on-scene incident command. This is a case where unified command worked very well, as it should, and the company officer on Rescue 4 and myself were able to talk on a tactical channel en route, and we basically had a plan established before we even got there. And the engine companies on scene had given us an area to set up anchor points. We used one of San Diego's trucks as an anchor point, so things went very well from that ass point from the very beginning.
And I think this is a good example of agencies working together on a regular basis. You become knowledgeable of each other's skill sets. From a safety perspective, Sherman, at an incident like this, what are some of the things we really need to be aware of that may be outside of our day-to-day responses?
Well, a low-angle rope rescue operation similar to one that occurred at Cabrillo National Monument is considered a high-risk, low-frequency event. So consequently, what happens is we train our people to be able to operate in an arena like that, but because it doesn't occur very often, their skills tend to get a little bit rusty over time. So what we try to do is we try to have periodic training, refresher training for everybody that would be involved in an event like that, so that when they get on scene, everybody knows what their role and responsibilities are. If everybody understands what the overall objective is for the incident, then, of course, just like any other type of incident, it minimizes the risk of somebody getting hurt or injured or doing something wrong during the duration of that event. So when we build up our systems, like John had said, we establish an incident command, and as part of that incident command, we have safety officers, and we make sure that anybody that goes over the side has properly has their personal protective equipment on, including their harnesses and all their safety gear. When they get down to make contact with patients, they look for any hazards, just like any other type of motor vehicle accident. And then they take care of those incidents, and then as they bring them up the embankment, they have the rope system built, established, so that they can safely evacuate the patient as well as the rescuers. At that point, the rescuers are just as important as the patient to get them back up on the safe ground.
I think that's a key point to hit on, no matter what aspect of technical rescue we talk about. So often, we have a tendency of putting the blinders on, and we get focused on the victim, but we have to always remember until our last member and our last piece of equipment is up on the cold zone where it's safe and sound, the incident's still in a live mode, and it's excellent that you guys are focusing on that. We definitely have to look out for number one first to make sure that we have those resources available tomorrow to go out to the next call that may come upon us. From this, not being real familiar with Cliff Rescue, coming from the part of the country I do, what are some of the logistical challenges you folks might have to face with the terrain and getting things functioning, and any specific rigging systems or techniques you use to minimize the hazard to both yourselves and the others?
Well, one of the things that we, the issues that we have on the West Coast here, the cliffs that we have in San Diego County and all probably throughout Southern California, they're all sandstone cliffs. They're not real hard-packed, firm, solid rock. It's very loose. And so when we approach a scene, anchoring off to our apparatus or creating anchors with picket systems becomes problematic because of the softness of the ground. So one of the first things that we address when we're learning rope rescue techniques is proper anchors and being able to utilize the rope systems that we have available to us off of anchors that are going to support the weight and hold the load as we're lowering and raising back up.
Excellent. And as we always say in rope rescue, you know, you're as good as your weakest link, and it's the foundation of our system, which is the anchor itself. If we don't take the time to do them properly, it really doesn't matter what we hook to them, because there's potential for something to go wrong.
That's right.
From the San Diego Fire Department perspective, Kyle, are there certain mechanical vantage systems you use as what we would refer to as our bread and butter type of systems?
Absolutely. We actually try to keep things fairly simple. Our mechanical vantage systems, obviously you can build one, you can get real crazy with it, but for the most part, that's why we bring in a lot of people to help assist with these types of rescues, so that we can build small, simple systems like a 3-to-1 mechanical advantage, or a 4-to-1, or even up to a 5-to-1. We try to keep it to a point where we don't want to go past building it, too big, because what happens is if you can picture, we have some of the rescuers and the victims down below, and they're the rescue team. They have packaged the victim and they're bringing them up. The people at the top may not always be able to have a line of sight to the victim and the rescuers below. So they start pulling, and we're going off of communications from radios. And the problem is, when you start building these mechanical vantage systems too big, you can potentially get people hurt. So it's a safety concern. We try to keep them small, anywhere from a 2-to-1, and we go all the way up to about a 5-to-1.
And listening to the distances you have to operate in, you get a 300-500 foot distance of operations. We all know in rope rescue, everything comes with a price. The higher the mechanical advantage, the more rope we have to move through a system. Equipment-wise, what are some of the average or the traditional rope lengths that you would carry as part of your cache in your departments?
Our department specifically has our trucks carry 300-foot rope bags, multiple 300-foot rope bags. But Rescue 4 has 500-foot rope bags. And going back to the Cabrillo National Monument incident, that's what we had to deploy because we did have a victim down 450 feet. So with building these mechanical vantage systems, we have to keep in mind how far down we're taking our rope line, how much rope we have up top to build. Do we have to add on extra rope? There's a lot of different things that are involved with that. One thing that will allow us when we're at the end of our line is to piggyback off that system. So that's where we would add a separate rope line, connect it to that main line, and we could use that to haul people up. And that's just an extension of the main line.
So it gives you a little bit of diversity where you can meet the needs of the incident with the skills that you have basically in that proverbial toolbox of knowledge and the equipment available to you.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and going back to, we talked about interjurisdictional training and knowledge, knowing what your neighbor has is very important. Again, their ladder companies we're carrying a certain length. I only carry a 200 footer. So knowing that, hey, you know, Rescue Force got the long enough ropes, you know, we want to knowing that ahead of time is going to really reduce a lot of time on scene, get them on the street early.
John mentioned one of the problems that we used to have about 25 years ago. So if you do automatic aid calls with other agencies, they have different equipment. They use it differently. And what we're trying to do in California now is have a standardized rope rescue program through state fire training. And it's the Rescue Systems One program that we teach here locally. And there are numerous schools up and down the state that teach the same curriculum. It's a state fire training curriculum, and the idea is that we become standardized from agency to agency, and we use the same type of equipment. We operate it the same way, and when we get together on automatic aid calls, everybody kind of is speaking the same language, and they understand what the objectives are, and they're able to work together as a cohesive unit. That's been a challenge in California over the years of getting multiple agencies on the same page pertaining to technical rope rescue, but I think we're a lot closer now than we were 20 years ago when I first started teaching.
I think that's a great advancement, and be it that your instructional cadre comes out of one centralized office, in this case the state fire marshal's office in California, it gives you that nucleus. We do a similar format in New York State, where we have the Office of Fire Prevention and Control, which is a very similar entity to your marshal's office, that creates a single credentialed standard that we try to get out to the different departments. Obviously, everybody has the opportunity to work within their own authority having jurisdiction, but by giving them the tools in advance, we're seeing a much stronger and a much more efficient operation taking place. And Sherman, you hit well on this earlier about the frequency and the hazards that we deal with. Much of technical rescue, rope rescue, or any of the other different spin-offs from it, are very low frequency, but the hazards are extremely high. And when budgets are tight, this is one of the areas we really need to beat the drum hard on to maintain the training that the members get. It's very easy to justify training for some of the more frequently dispatched types of events. So by having a good core of people and a support mechanism within the state for you, I think it's really going to build your future in a positive manner where we don't leave the citizens we serve short. Looking at more tactical activities related to this particular incident, we have our main lines. We talked a little bit about our haul systems in California through your Rescue Systems One program or some of your others. What do you focus or utilize for blaze or backup systems?
Yeah, we use the exact same rated line that we'd use for a main line or lowering or hauling line as our backup line, as our belay line, fall protection. You know, many different names get put on it. So we don't use any different type of rope. We use the same type of rope, static kern mantle, usually in half inch diameter. We attach that to what we call a tandem prussic belay. I'm sure the guys would allude to this, that over time we've seen a lot of different techniques come out. We used to belay on 8 plates, Gibbs ascenders, and things like that, but through time-tested events and finding out how things work, it's like a lot of things come back around. I remember starting out in early 80s in this stuff using prussics. It kind of went away for a while. Now we're back to using prussics again because we're finding out maybe they were the best tool for the job. So we use what they call a tandem prussic belay. I particularly like it because it keeps my belay person both hands on that line. He can feel what's going on, and it really keeps him focused on what his job is and just letting some mechanical device use it where it doesn't really have feeling, so to speak.
And I think that's a key point, focus. The belay person position, however we like to refer to it, is kind of the unsung hero. Other than in training where we deploy them for learning purposes, it's hopefully the one aspect that you'll deploy at every incident you respond to in your career and never have the misfortune to see it activated. With your tandem prussics, do you use any type of release hitch or any type of system assistance device within that?
Yeah, attached to the tandem prussics, we have what's called a load release device, and we used to use a mariner's hitch, but that is no longer accepted in California. So the load release device is used, and it acts kind of like as a shock absorber if the tandem prussics are loaded in a fall, and then you're able to open it up and take the load off of those tandem press six back onto a main line in the event of activation of your belay line.
Okay, what specific systems do you utilize in your teaching system?
Well, the primary system that we use for rope rescue in the state of California is the RPM system. The RPM system includes a number of pieces of equipment that are gathered together on an anchor plate, including a brake bar rack, a load release device, and a couple of sets of pulleys, and then some prussic loops. And with that RPM, attach it to an anchor, we can use it basically on any type of rope rescue system that we would need. So that's the basic fundamental piece of equipment that we have. We can use it for belay line, we can use it for rappel line, we can use it for mechanical advantage, change of direction, a number of different aspects. So the RPM is the basic unit that we use.
Now, Kyle, coming from a heavy rescue, I know the rescue I used to work with in our department, we were big on pre-rigging. For training purposes, we always build a la carte to get the students' hands manipulating the tools. But for responses, we always felt it was best the more we can have prepared ahead of time, obviously, the more efficient we will be. Your particular cache on Rescue 4, is this the type of direction you've gone, or how do you prepare your equipment for a response?
We absolutely keep everything pre-assembled, starting with our anchors. To give you an example, we have pre-tied ropes that are in a loop that have hose on the, kind of sleeve on the rope, so that we can just quickly throw down an anchor and build out from there. We have, as Sherman talked about, the RPM systems. We have two of them, which will deploy on most incidents. We can build the tandem pressic belay off of the RPM system, so it's like a little mini toolbox. So we have two of them. We can basically walk up, build two anchor points, set down the two RPMs, and the sky's the limit.
It's a great tool, and it's a system that we're very familiar with on the East Coast. We use it heavily within our department, and as you said, it gives you that flexibility to go into action quickly with all the tools you need instead of trying to find them on a large staging tarp. I know in our particular department, we've evolved similar to what you've alluded to in earlier conversation today with our release systems. What we've gone to is in our low angle and our newer students, we stick with a mariner's hitch as the load release device at low angle. But once we've gone into high angle, we've evolved into what we utilize is the BC or the British Columbia load release hitch. There's a few others out in the rescue fields that are equally as efficient, work as well, but as Sherman hit on, it gives us that little bit of a dynamic feature using a low stretch material so that we're assisting our people's safety level to a degree in the event of a deployment or a failure of the main line. The big thing we sometimes don't take into consideration, others looking from the outside in, is that we're working a main line that's fully stretched to its manufactured rating, being protected by a loose line, the belay line, which is yet to be stretched. So if there is a failure, we have to have something to take care of that shifting of weights and a mechanism of releasing the tension that we put in it. As John said, these tandem prussics work exceptionally well. One of the things that's big on the East Coast now are different manufactured belay devices. Some of them are very good. Like any tool of the trade, you have to have the proper training. We run into situations where buying something, putting it on the load, is only half the game. It's getting the proper training and knowing its do's and its don'ts that are going to take us, to the next level. Going back a little bit to the incident at the National Monument, how is command and control handled? The West Coast is renowned for incident management, coming from the wildfire community and from talking to individuals out here in the past and during this week. It's something that it's not just a conversation, it's a way of life. It's part of how you function. Kind of give us a little insight on the benefits of that and how it pertained to this incident in particular.
Well, I know being the first agency that was on scene for that, and knowing that we were going to have a multi-jurisdictional response, getting into unified command quickly was going to spell success for us. And again, California, working with the California Incident Command System the way we do, allowed us to quickly adapt to that type of situation. Again, common ground across the board. You know, we in our Southern California, we get into our wildland situations. We're getting responses from Northern California, you know, quite a few hundred miles away. And it's amazing when they get here, they operate under the same communication guidelines as we do. We talk the same talk, the same terminology when it comes to the command level type of communications. And that is absolutely so important, because you get into different terminologies and I don't really understand what you're asking me, I could spell out for some disaster.
Some of the issues that we've run into, I've done a number of low angle rescue operations in my jurisdiction over the years. And it's, as soon as you get a vehicle over the side of a road surface and you need to do a rope system to evacuate somebody, it's going to be a minimum of a first alarm assignment. Anytime you have a first alarm assignment, you're going to assume command and create that command structure in order to run that incident smoothly. So pretty much any rope rescue operation is going to be the same way. We have an incident commander, we have a safety officer, sometimes it's the same person, sometimes not. And then we have a rescue group, and then we have a rigging group. Typically the rigging group is the one that builds the system at the top. The rescue group are the individuals who are going to go down and make patient contact, package that patient, and then assist them back up to the road surface or wherever the ambulance is waiting. So that rescue group, that rigging group are the two that actually fall under operations. They take care of those particular aspects. And then we may have a medical group for patient care and treatment and transport. And then all the other aspects of the incident command system are in place on some level or another during any kind of rope rescue operation.
It sounds like an excellent example of everybody knowing their responsibility, so the efficiency has to be extremely high as compared to three people doing one task and no one doing another. Utilizing your system, I think it really enhances the way you function out here, which is a major positive.
Yeah, and this call really brought all those elements together, because we had not only engine companies, truck companies, rescue companies, we had a helicopter involved in this operations with, again, as Sherm talked, now we have an air operations element that we got to put into our play. So this is a good example of all that coming together in a unified and a command type structure.
Excellent. And Kyle, coming from a larger municipal department, how is incident command basically put forward within your department's operational capabilities?
It's a part of every incident. Not your typical EMS call, but your standard fire calls, any kind of a high-rise situation. The incident command system in itself definitely helps keep everything organized, keeps everybody on the same page. It allows us to do our job more effectively. And ultimately, it's been with us here for quite a little while here, and it's keeping us up, you know, basically helping us run our incidents a lot more smooth.
It sounds like something that those people in other parts of the country who talk about incident command should maybe take a page out of the book and see, where it's just a functional aspect of every call you go on. It makes it a very positive part of how you do your business.
And one of the things that we do when we hire new firefighters on the job is they immediately start learning the incident command system, and very soon within their fire service career, they get a greater understanding of how it works. That way, as they progress up the promotion ladder, when they get to the position where they would be an incident commander, they will understand the different roles and responsibilities within that system.
Excellent.
Yes, John. And I think to really emphasize incident command too is, and I see a lot of guys doing this, is they only think they have to use it on the big call. That's not the case. You use it even on the everyday meat and potatoes calls that we go on, because if you're practicing it on the smaller calls, maybe you're just dealing with one or two units, but you're still assigning these taskings under the incident command system, it's going to fall into place on the big ones like this. So practicing it every day and your everyday responses is going to give you successful on the bigger calls.
I totally agree, and I think when you use it on the day-to-day calls, you are more versed and capable of handling the large-scale events. Fortunately, you're very well versed at it. Unfortunately, you have many natural type of events on the West Coast, be it earthquakes, mudslides, wildland fires, that are long-term operations. In general, the fire service, we're used to most of our calls can be handled in a very short window of time with a very quick rollover. Very seldom do we have to do shift changes in multi-shift type of an events where some of the specific activities you deal with out on this coast are of the magnitude they're not mitigated in one shift or one day. So it even shows a greater importance of having a mechanism in place to help keep everything moving forward so that you can get to that final point where you can say, okay, the last person can go home. Part of getting there obviously falls back on your preparation. One of the things the three of you hold in common is being instructors with your state system. The one course we talked a little bit about prior to the session today is your Rescue Systems 1, which is, the way I'm understanding it, the meat and potatoes technical rescue course in California. Sherman talked about how standardizing the entire state's training to where everybody is getting the same general startup point and throughout their training so that they can work together. Kind of give us a little background on this course and what's entailed when a student, you know, walks in the door the first day, Sherman.
Well, one of the things that the state had tried to institute a number of years ago by standardizing this is it kind of occurred at the same time that they started establishing the FEMA task forces for major disaster incidents, and we've seen a number of them in the last recent couple of decades. So a firefighter walks in the door, they're going to register for the class, and we give them an overview of the incident command system as a review. We give them an overview of how that incident command system fits into a disaster recovery type operation, whether it's technical rope rescue or other aspects of rescue systems. And then as they progress through the training, they're given certain tasks that they need to accomplish and certain types of equipment that from our training aspect is standardized equipment that any engine company or truck company should have available to them. As they progress up into more advanced training levels and they get onto one of these task forces throughout the state, then they will get additional training that's even more technical and there's more tools and equipment. So by given the basic understanding of technical rope rescue in the Rescue Systems 1 and the LARO courses, the firefighters are able to go back to their jobs and utilize that training on an engine company or truck company level, and then they can progress up into more technical training, such as what Kyle does on Rescue 4, and then if they get onto a task force, they'll learn even more technical stuff. So it's basically the basic method that they learn that they can use on a day-to-day basis and then build on that.
Excellent. One of the things Sherm alluded to, John, if you want to pick up on this, is there's more to Rescue Systems 1 than rope rescue activities. Today we're kind of focusing on cliff rescues, rope-related type of activities. What are some of the other components of Rescue System 1s beyond our rope work?
Well, I'll take part of the system that I teach, and maybe Kyle can talk a little bit about his section. It's actually a four-module course. It's taught over a series of 40 hours. Usually for us, it's a Monday through Friday type thing. And again, you know, I want to emphasize that this is that foundation that we start with, you know, to build the house, so to speak. You know, I know we're talking about rope rescue, but the class itself encompasses not just rope rescue, emergency building shoring operations, heavy objects moving, where we're doing a lot with cribbing, lifting and cribbing type things. I think the smallest object we move at the school is somewhere in the neighborhood of about 3 or 4 tons, so it's quite heavy. And we also use ladder rescue systems. A lot of folks forget that, you know, we think we only use ladders to climb on the roof and cut holes and pull people out of windows, but that's not the case. They are a great tool as far as rescue work goes and stuff. And I'll pass on to Kyle and let him talk about one of the specialties he does. I do the ladder stuff mostly.
Well, like John was saying, you know, the class itself is designed to build the foundation for the student, you know. A lot of them come in, our students come in, they're already firefighters, but some of them aren't. And what they can expect when they come in is to leave this class with a good foundation, a good solid knowledge of what rescue is. Here, specific to San Diego, we have a lot of fault lines that run throughout this area, and when the class was designed, to my understanding, they had that in mind. Was to build and set it up so that we could effectively use emergency building shoring and heavy objects and those different things, and then the rope stuff was added in later on as the course excelled. And so basically, as the way the course was designed, with the students in mind, was to give them a good solid foundation to build them up, and they can go from there and increase their skill level.
Very good. And as part of the country that's, you know, worked through a number of different disasters, man-made type of activities and natural disasters as well, you know, that preparedness is so important that we can have our members capable of going out and functioning in the worst case scenarios. We look at a lot of what we do as preparing for the unexpected, or there's a lot of catchphrases you'll see. It's not if it will happen, but when it will happen, things of that nature. And I think it sounds like the system here in California has done a very good job of preparing for that. And, you know, these are the type of things where sharing your resources, the mutual aid that you do on a regular basis, helping one another out and knowing each other's capabilities and limitations is key to a successful operation. Kyle, one of the things you mentioned during the incident you had at the National Monument was the assistance of a helicopter coming in and taking one of the victims out with a hoist system. And second, you referenced water rescue by having some type of a watercraft available. What type of crafts are in the inventory locally that would assist you both in the air and on the water at a rescue scene?
Well, we have one copter available to us, which is Copter One, and we use them on all kinds of different incidents, whether it's a structure fire, whether it's a wildland fire, or something like this rope rescue incident. Also, we have the lifeguards. Our lifeguard system here in San Diego, they actually fall under the fire department, so they're a part of us, our
okay.
team. What they have available are several different types of boats that can effectively help us with the rope rescue instance. Also, they have a rope rescue team, a cliff rescue team, that also works with our our rescue personnel to effectively make cliff rescues, and they're also certified with water rescue type scenarios.
So you have a pretty deep system.
A couple of additional agencies that we can use in a situation like that would be the San Diego Harbor Patrol. They're a branch of the police department, but they patrol San Diego Harbor itself. They have some training in rescue operations and firefighting operations. And then in addition to that, we have a Coast Guard station right here in San Diego, and we can utilize them if we had to, too, if we had some watercraft-related rescues that we needed to get assistance from.
So it shows that, you know, going back to our component of incident command, a unified command operation is very realistic because of all the various agencies, be it local, state, federal, that could be on site for one event almost instantaneously. So it just once again reinforces the importance of having some type of a command and control module in place to get all the resources working well together.
Yeah, and fortunate as it is in Southern California with our wildland situation, I can't think of too many Southern California firefighters that don't know how to work with an aircraft. We use aircraft on a daily basis in the wildland environment. So being able to use a resource like that and communicate with a resource like that, or luckily it's actually fairly easy for us. But you know, the use of helicopters are high risk. They do bring that level to it, but they're a great access.
And having that capability available to you, it definitely enhances your options. Once again, by having that in the community, you may not need it on the call, but in the back of your head, if you're a command component of the operation, you know you can reach out and grab that resource up or have it staged and ready for you.
Well, absolutely, because in that situation where we had two people entrapped 400 feet down, somebody's going to have, if we didn't have a helicopter asset in this particular environment who airlifted one out, hoisted one out literally within minutes, you know, one of those victims was going to have to wait. I forget what the time frame was, but it is pretty lengthy to rig these systems and move someone up a hillside like that and then have to redeploy troops back down to retrieve the second victim. So, again, the air assets are invaluable.
Yeah, it definitely comes into play. And I think Kyle touched a little bit earlier, too, on the potential of knowing your environment and training to where bringing the individual back up isn't always the best answer. He talked about how you could make contact with a patient and then continue them down into a safe haven, in this case, a boat or some type of a water vessel, and then, once again, expediting their travel from our care to the advanced EMS component, handing them off and getting them into that level of care in a more timely manner. So it sounds like we've got a really good teamwork concept here is basically a way of life. Some people look from the outside in and think that these things just happen on their own, but I think what we've got here is a number of years of interagency activities and a overhead support via the state fire marshal's office in this case that helps really create a positive dynamic for, you know, technical rescue in California, in our case this week down here in the southern part of it, but I think up and down the whole coast it would probably be a very similar type of operation.
Yes, you could go anywhere in California, get the same similar training. The incident command system is the same up and down the state. Multiple agencies participate in it wherever you go within the state of California. It's been years and years in the making, and it's an ongoing project for state fire training and for all the people who train and participate in these activities. But it's something that we're constantly working on, and every year it gets better and better.
That sounds good. We're going to start wrapping up here shortly. You know, I just wanted to thank, you know, John, Sherman, and Kyle for you three joining me today. It was an excellent chance to share your experiences and get some knowledge from people from another part of the country. Hopefully this is something that our listeners will really get some benefits from, hearing the firsthand examples from the cliff rescue you had and then some of the training components that you're involved in on, you know, another aspect of your lives. You know, once again, I want to thank you for coming. Any last words, John?
No, Bob, thank you very much. It's been a joy to sit here and pass on some of our experiences and our system that we have out here. I think it's a good system. Be more than happy to share it with anyone.
Great. Kyle?
Well, Bob, appreciate you having us, allowing us to share our knowledge with everybody out there, and I hope this helps keep everybody safe.
Definitely. And Sherman?
Thank you very much for the opportunity. It's interesting to hear some of the things that occur on the East Coast, and it sounds like we do things a lot more similar than what I had initially thought. So it's very enlightening to me as well.
That's one of the great things about the fire service as a whole, I think. We all get our mail in a different location, but when you put a group of us together, we really start realizing just how much we're all alike.
Absolutely.
You guys are probably pretty weak in the area of ice rescue, but yep. We'll leave that for another day's conversation, and maybe we can get together over another time and place and discuss that. But, you know, we hope you enjoyed today's session, and please check out radio@firehouse.com for more podcasts from Firehouse World. This is your host, Bob Dumel, for The Buzz on Technical Rescue. Thank you so much for listening, and be safe.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.